And William's got a major discussion coming up now about reptilians and the Anunnaki, so get ready for that. Hold on to your chairs for that one. Let's talk about reptilians and the Anunnaki, William. What's this major discovery?
Well, for years, people have been talking about these amazing ancient legends that are really worldwide about giant flying lizards and dragons that came to this planet and had a hand in founding civilizations from ancient China to Egypt to India. And in the modern era, we talk about reptilians, and people have a tremendous fear of reptilians. And a lot of this, I think, can be attributed to the work of R.A. Boulay and his work Flying Serpents and Dragons. And then certainly David Icke picked up on this and introduced this idea that there's this reptilian faction of beings that are actually controlling the world. They manipulate the bloodlines of some of the royal families, for example, the British royal family, and they're considered to be, you might even think of them as the heads of the Anunnaki. And I've been listening to this for a long time and tried to keep an open mind about it. And then as I started doing this research into the seraphim, this highest order of angels, I noticed, well, first of all, when you look up the word seraphim, the word means the winged and fiery serpents, or simply the fiery serpents. And when I look at this, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, isn't that the same as the definition of the reptilians? Could there be a connection between these alien reptilians that David Icke and others are talking about and the seraphim? And if so, how do you reconcile David Icke's view of the reptilians with this ancient view of the seraphim as the highest level of beings in the Judeo-Christian tradition? What's going on here? And so I decided to spend some time looking into this. And one of the reasons that it's very important for us to look at this, by the way, is because Maya 2012 prophecy centers around the reappearance of their savior figure, whose name is Quetzalcoatl, whose name means the feathered serpent or the winged serpent. Mm-hmm. So is this a David Icke-style reptilian being with a crocodile nose that's coming here to eat us? Or are we, in fact, really talking about the highest order of beings that in the Judeo-Christian angelic tradition? That is Quetzalcoatl also a seraphim? Are these beings actually reptilian? Or did the ancients somehow have a conception that something about the seraphim is serpentine or serpent-like? For example, they're described as resplendent and shining. But what is it about them that caused them to describe them as serpentine? And as I started matching this up, and I have some images that Lex has posted on the Coast to Coast site that show the correspondence between the seraphim and the rainbow body of Tibetan Buddhism. And what we see with the seraphim is that their bodies are feathered, they're winged, and their bodies are also vortex-shaped. These are the winged serpents. These are the quote-unquote reptilians, or what has been, I believe, misconstrued as the reptilians. These are not these kind of strange crocodile-nosed kind of beings that of David Icke's research. These are a far different type of being that we're dealing with here, and I think what we're actually describing are transformed humans, humans who have achieved this next level, who have achieved the rainbow body, and they manifest. When they manifest, here's what I see happening here, is that as these beings manifest, they are traveling through stargates and wormholes. And in one of the images that I have posted on the Coast site, it's a Tibetan image of the rainbow body. And we see this awakened being, this enlightened being manifesting. And as we look at its neck, it's almost serpentine looking. It has this swirling rainbow energy around it with a gateway surrounding it. And when I began to ponder, and actually it was David Wilcock who affirmed that, hey, this makes a lot of sense, is that it looks like it. The serpent being description is a primitive interpretation of seeing this luminous or shining stargate behind these people when they first materialize. And this makes more sense to me, certainly, than this possibility that we're talking about some kind of reptilian creatures. Now, I'm not saying that David Icke is wrong or that R.A. Boulay is wrong. I'm saying that there's a possibility that there is this other group of perhaps crocodile-nosed tall beings. But when we're actually talking about a reptilian race of winged serpents, flying serpents and dragons, in the ancient world, they're talking about the seraphim. They're talking about the highest order of angels.
Well, that's a good point. Now, these flying creatures have been worldwide legends, haven't they?
Every single tradition from ancient Sumeria to Egypt to India to China has examples of these beings. And in fact, David Icke has a video on his website where he goes through and shows, look, here's Osiris. He's described as a serpent, and he's got ostrich feathers on. And my point is, well, why don't we key on the ostrich feathers and say he's a bird being instead of saying he's a serpent being? He's actually a winged serpent. If he's described as serpentine and he has ostrich feathers, that means he's a hybrid being. He's not just a reptilian being. He is, in fact, a winged serpent. So this is a classic example of how this gets underinterpreted. Perhaps there's a desire on the part of some people to just freak people out and to terrify them and to terrorize them by saying that there's this reptilian race out here that's coming to eat us. But I don't think that that's true at all. And part of what I'm here to do is to kind of say, let's back off that just a little bit, and let's just take a really deeper look at this. Because if I drove a Hummer, I could actually drive holes or drive my Hummer through the holes in the research that's been done on these reptilian beings. And I'm not trying to sound angry here. I'm just very passionate about this because I'm very concerned that people might, in fact, be deeply, deeply misled by thinking that these beings are in some way malevolent and they're not here for our highest interest.
I guess because they look that way, they don't look friendly, do they?
Well, in the case of the rainbow body, they do appear to be friendly. In other instances, they are portrayed as half human and half serpent. A classic example of this is the Sumerian creator god Enki. He's the one who's credited with crafting the human body, of altering it. When you see depictions of him, he's portrayed as a spirit, specifically a water spirit, and he's shown as half human and half serpent. There is something within us that has been programmed to, perhaps coming from the reptilian brain, to fear beings that are half human and half serpent. But in fact, virtually all of the God beings, including Jesus, have been connected with the serpent. Moses describes lifting the serpent of healing, the fiery serpent, which by definition is a seraphim. So Moses made a seraphim in the ancient world. And then later, Jesus directly connected himself with the seraphim, saying, as Moses lifted the serpent in the wilderness, which is actually the seraphim, the fiery serpent, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So why we fear this is kind of strange to me when you have all of the greatest lawgivers and teachers actually and directly connecting themselves with this being. I think what's ultimately behind this, George, is some kind of we just have to call it a conspiracy. There is a faction that is out there that does not want humankind to transform, that does not want humankind to achieve the next level of our spiritual evolution into light beings. They want to keep us down on the farm, so they freak us out, scaring us with the story of these reptilian beings that if you go anywhere near any of this teaching, you're in some kind of Illuminati plot that is here to kind of eat you for lunch. And that is simply not true.
Should we take the chance?
Well, what we should take the chance and do is really look at the wisdom that is behind this. What are they actually talking about here? Who are these beings, and who has been out there seeking to prevent us from achieving this next level? Part of it, in the tradition of the seraphim, these winged serpents or fiery serpents, they are described as beings of pure light and pure love whose frequency is so high that if a human were to encounter one of these beings, they would run the risk of being incinerated. So that's one reason right there, one benevolent reason for people to teach or for stories to be inserted in the Bible, in the Sumerian tradition, and elsewhere to be mindful of these beings. The serpent of Eden, our friend Mike Heiser, for example, has pointed out that Nakash, the serpent of Eden, is in fact one of these beings is the bright snake or shining serpent of Eden, is a fiery serpent. That means that the serpent of Eden is not a reptile, is not a reptilian being. The serpent of Eden is a seraphim, one of these highest order of angels. And in fact, in Sitchin's work, he says that the serpent of Eden is in fact Enki, a being who sought to uplift us to the level of the gods and even to help us to exceed the capabilities of the gods and achieve our ultimate transformation into light beings.
The Egyptian lore also has these kinds of beings as well, clearly depicted in sculptures and everything else. Do you think that these are beings that originated from this planet? Were they extraterrestrial? Were they dimensional? Where'd they come from?
Well, they are said, in the case of the seraphim, in these winged serpents, seraphim do appear in Egyptian temple descriptions, and even on the throne chair of Tutankhamun. We are told that the seraphim dwell at the throne of God. In fact, in depictions, and I have these in my Soul Rising presentation, you see Jesus holding a seraphim in his hands as he's sitting on his throne. You see him with seraphim on either side of his throne. We are told that the throne of God is some perhaps indeterminable cosmic center. But in my work, I actually localize it based on the evidence that I've turned up in my research in this regard. I localize it into the Milky Way. If we think of our Milky Way galaxy as the throne that is described, as the temple that is described in the ancient texts, then the Holy of Holies, where the throne is located, must be the center of the galaxy. What do you know? Many mystic traditions, shamanic traditions, teach that the center of the galaxy is inhabited by millions of transformed humans who are existing in their light form. They teach us that the center of the Milky Way galaxy is the place that our souls came from. So what I propose or hypothesize is, well, what if we play along with this and suggest the throne of God, the throne of Jesus, is in fact the center of the Milky Way galaxy? This is where the seraphim dwell, and this is where the Mayans say one of these seraphim, the winged serpent, the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, will be emerging from in 2012.
And they believe in his return, don't they, right around?
Yes, they do. They believe in his return. He'll be traveling through a serpent rope, which could be a wormhole, according to John Major Jenkins, and I think he's right. I think that the way that these beings travel is through stargates and wormholes, and when they manifest on the Earth plane, they manifest as five-colored rainbow light, as rainbow beings with this gateway behind them that could be interpreted to a primitive mind, a pre-technological mind, as, in fact, a serpent opening its mouth or a wormhole opening its mouth. We now know it's actually a stargate or a wormhole.
William, was it Quetzalcoatl that is depicted on stone as if he's sitting at the instrument panel of some kind of craft? Is that him?
Yeah, that's Lord Pakal. That's
Pakal.
Right.
Okay.
Yep, he's on the world tree, the sacred tree, the cosmic cross, which is linking heaven and earth, linking earth with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And I'm really glad you brought that up, George, because one of the other images that's posted on the Coast site is called the Cosmic Cross. And what is shown there is this correspondence between the Mayan image, the Mixtec and Mayan image of two priests on either side of the sacred tree, which represents the 2012 galactic alignment. This tree is T-shaped and it's topped by a bird. To the Mayans, this T-shaped cross symbolizes a portal or a gateway into the spirit world. What I've done is matched it up, for example, with Botticelli's painting of the crucifixion, which shows John the Baptist on one side, Mary Magdalene on the other side, of Jesus on the exact same T-shaped cross with a similar bird topping it with a portal opened behind him. This is really interesting because it's saying that this imagery is not just isolated to the Mayans. It's in the Christian tradition as well. And not just the Mayans and the Christians talk about this galactic alignment, so do the Egyptians, because on the temple walls of the ancient Temple of Seti at Abydos, we see the exact same scenario depicted. Two priests on either side of a T-shaped cross that symbolizes a portal or a gateway, topped by a bird, symbolic of the bird of heaven, especially the ibis or heron, the bird that symbolizes to the Mayans the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So all three of these depictions are in fact describing this cosmic alignment, 2012, and the opening of a portal or a gateway with beings coming and going through that portal or gateway.
Are they coming via a craft?
No.
How are they getting here? They're not.
Nope. Mayan symbolism suggests they're coming through this umbilical cord called a serpent rope that is likely actually a wormhole. And these beings that are coming and going, in this instance, in the Maya 2012 prophecy, is the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl. The feathered serpent, the term feathered serpent, is the very definition of the Judeo-Christian seraphim angels, these beings who have achieved the next level of human, who have transformed into light beings. So what we're suggesting here is that we're talking about a portal opening and these light beings coming and going from within it.
Well, let's talk, if we can, a little bit about Ezekiel and this wheel. You call it the Merkabah. Tell me about that.
The Merkabah, one of the definitions for that is the throne chariot. I mean, these beings have to travel in something. And so you've got a lot of researchers, especially UFO researchers, that say, oh, you know, this throne chariot, that must be a UFO. That must be some kind of technological craft that these beings are flying around the cosmos in. But in fact, in the esoteric tradition out of which the Merkabah emerges, they're saying, no. The Merkabah is, in fact, a light vehicle. It is these figures have transformed themselves into the Merkabah, the space-time light vehicle, and they travel the cosmos as light beings. Ezekiel encountered one of these. Elijah ascended into the heavens in a whirlwind, a vortex, that many believe is actually one of these Merkabah vehicles. Jesus appears to have utilized the Merkabah vehicle as well, and certainly the seraphim do too.
In some of the depictions that we see, ancient depictions, there are pictures of craft in the background, William. I mean, you've seen some of these.
Yeah.
You've been to Abydos. You've seen that as well.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Well, some of them could legitimately be called UFOs. Others are explainable. I am not a proponent of the idea that these vastly advanced beings are traveling. I should say this, that all of them are traveling in hard or technological metallic craft. The ones that I'm interested in are those who are traveling in these light vehicles. These are organic craft. They are light beings. And we're talking about a race of beings who are far more evolved than extraterrestrials who travel in UFOs. The ones who are in UFOs are maybe, 150 years in advance evolutionary or technologically speaking from where we're at right now. If we haven't already done it, and according to some people we have, we're already doing the time travel Stargate thing. That's already a done deal, according to the so-called insiders who have witnessed this. So we're at this level right now. The beings that we want to catch up with, the ones that I feel like we really want to be paying attention to, are those who have already achieved the highest level of transformation, this high order of angels that dwell in the center of the galaxy, the seraphim, and this type of being.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to also talk about the Anunnaki, and also get into some ancient text, an ancient work of William Henry, some of what could astound you. So get ready for that. If you need to email me, george@coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment with William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with William Henry. By the way, on our next Coast to Coast program, Timothy Schultz joins us as we talk about ghosts and hauntings. So get ready for that little here, Turner, on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back with William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. William, do you believe the Anunnaki might have been serpents?
No, I don't. I think that when they manifested to the primitive mind, that they might have appeared to be serpentine, because again, they were resplendent, they were shimmering, they were shining, and ultimately the highest level of the ones I focus on, Enki especially, seem to be traveling through these gateways and portals that we today call wormholes. And so the idea is that as they manifested on the earth plane to the primitive mind, they appeared perhaps as serpentine being. Now, that said, there are depictions in the British Museum, for example, and in the Seckler Gallery in Washington, D.C., that show these primitive beings that appear to be reptilian or have serpentine kind of faces. So there could, be a group that were presented in this way or were perceived as this way. But ultimately, the connection I'm making is to say, if you're describing the Anunnaki as serpents, the serpents of wisdom, these are beings who have achieved the highest level of transformation, what we today call the rainbow body. And in that manifestation, they appear to be somewhat serpentine.
Enki, as you have reported, might have been denigrated, demonized. Why?
Well, his sole desire, according to the Sumerian stories, was to uplift humankind, to even allow humankind to exceed the capabilities of the gods.
He was on our side, right?
He was on our side, yeah, exactly. An entirely benevolent being, but it is his half-brother, Enlil, who's more militaristic, as he's presented in the stories, that doesn't want humankind to have these capabilities. One, because we would rival the gods in our capabilities, and two, we probably wouldn't need them anymore. And so those are two justifications for why Enki was denigrated, and I think it leads to this conclusion that, or that certainly this question, that some being or group of entities, probably the Anunnaki, switched off or disabled critical spiritual functions of our DNA, neutered us in a sense, so that we wouldn't be able to match the Anunnaki and we would forever be subservient to them. Then they come into our sacred texts, such as the Old Testament, and implant these stories that tell us, oh, beware of the serpent of wisdom. Don't go near this being. Trouble lurks here. And so what happens is you have people that don't have any concept of their true spiritual capability. They think this is all that is, the human body I'm speaking of. Little do they know that part of our earthly quest is to learn the secrets of the human body, of our DNA, of the double helix, which was in fact Enki's hieroglyph, and activate these capabilities to overcome this, if you want to call it, diabolical switch off, turn everything back on, and light ourselves up. That is our goal. And if to the extent that people buy into this idea that we can't do that, and people tell me all the time, how dare you say that people can become whole, holy, and complete? You sound like you're Satan. You sound that Satan would say that.
They say that to you?
Yes, they do. I get emails to this effect from people saying that that's what Lucifer would have you believe. That's what Satan would have you believe, that you can become whole, holy, and complete. How dare you, you pathetic piece of human garbage, believe that you can transform yourself into a glorious light being. I'm being maybe a little overdramatic here, but that's the sentiment. That's the basic foundation of Christianity, that we all are sinners, that we don't, and we're sinners because we don't match the glory of God. And the glory of God, the word glory means to glow rays, to glow rainbow rays. So if you're a sinner, it just simply means you're not in your rainbow body, and that pretty much encompasses just about everybody. But the way to overcome this is to activate our spiritual capability, to embrace it, not to be in fear of it.
Are you a believer in the 12th planet?
No, I'm not. I'm not at all a believer in that. And I mentioned Mike Heiser earlier. He pretty well gave me the Kool-Aid that woke me up from the whole Sitchin 12th planet scenario when he introduced his research into the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary. The 12th planet is called Nibiru. And as he noted, when you go into the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, which is considered the ultimate authority on the Sumerian language, Nibiru is called the Nibiru. And the definition of the Nibiru is it is a star, a gate, and a crossing point. Now, Mike disagrees with my linking those words together, saying you can't add the words star and gate together to come up with a conclusion or hypothesis that Nibiru is in fact a stargate, but that's my operating premise, that these beings are light beings who travel the universe through stargates and wormholes in the Nibiru. I just don't subscribe to the 12th planet scenario any longer.
The bloodlines that David Icke has talked about, where he believes that the reptilians are ruling the planet right now. As far-fetched as it sounds, William, there could be an air of truth to that and believability.
Yep, there could be. And I'm not telling anybody that, you know, don't follow David Icke. You know, he's constantly, like Jordan Maxwell, feeling like he's persecuted, that people are out to get him. And that they're going to try to somehow destroy his message. I'm not that guy. I'm saying, yeah, go for it. Research that. Take a look at it. But I would encourage you to spend equal time taking a deeper look at this imagery, at these beings, and say, well, wait a minute. These winged serpents that appear all over the place as seraphim, these aren't beings that are trying to somehow control the banking system of Earth. They have a little bit more on their mind than that. They are not interested in earthly control. They are interested in waking humankind up to their true spiritual potential. That's what this big game is all about. So if you're focused on which Rockefeller is doing what to which, pick another Illuminati bloodline, yeah, that could be a good use of your time, but I'm saying let's focus on what they're really trying to get us to, what they're really trying to withhold from us, which is the keys to unlocking our DNA. How do we connect with these higher order of beings? How, in fact, do we become such beings? That, to me, is the far more interesting and, I think, a much more fruitful way to spend your research time.
William, you went to Assisi in Italy just a few months ago. You have a few stories to tell, don't you?
I do. I mean, the reason I went there, George, is because I was standing in the I was in the Philadelphia Museum of Art a couple of years ago when I was doing my research on the Capitol, and I'm standing in front of a painting by John Van Eck of St. Francis of Assisi receiving the stigmata wounds from Jesus, and I'm looking at this painting and going, why is Jesus portrayed as a butterfly? It was one of the weirdest things I had ever seen. And then upon doing further research, I realized that Jesus isn't shown as a butterfly. He's shown as a seraphim. Jesus manifested as a winged serpent, as a seraphim, as a feathered serpent to St. Francis in the 13th century and beamed the stigmata wounds of crucifixion, the five wounds of Jesus on the cross of crucifixion, to St. Francis as rays of light. And I'm looking at this going, well, wait a minute. Why is it that St. Francis, who is considered the second Christ and the most perfect and pure Christian, the ultimate Christian model in the modern era, why did he perceive Jesus as a winged serpent? Is Jesus a reptilian? No. Jesus is manifesting in this way because he has achieved the ultimate human transformation. In his resurrection scenes, in Last Judgment scenes, when Jesus is shown enthroned, he is always shown on a rainbow or in a rainbow. And as I show in my presentation, Soul Rising, I've got a huge collection of these images of Jesus on the rainbow or in the rainbow, and I match them with the Tibetan images of their lamas who've achieved the rainbow body. And my hypothesis is that the reason why Jesus is shown on the rainbow is because he has achieved the ultimate human transformation into the rainbow body. But he doesn't always stay on his throne, which I, as I mentioned earlier, locate in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. He toggles back and forth. And when he manifested as an apparition, as a full-spectrum rainbow being, that's what the word apparition means, when he appeared as an apparition to St. Francis, he appeared as a seraphim, as a feathered serpent. And guess what? The Mayans say that Quetzalcoatl is a feathered serpent, and the Mormons come in and say Jesus and Quetzalcoatl are the same.
I was going to ask you that. And what about the Mormons and their belief?
There you have it. The Mormons believe that after his crucifixion, that Jesus appeared in America. Now, if he's appearing after his resurrection, this is after Jesus has achieved full glory. When Jesus is shown in full glory, he is shown with a rainbow around him or coming from within him. So if this is literally true, then what the Mormons are saying is that Jesus manifested or appeared in his rainbow body in America after his resurrection. And they believe that he is actually Quetzalcoatl, that Jesus came to America, to Mesoamerica, to continue his work, and he was known as the feathered serpent, which means he appeared as a seraphim, and he was also known as the peacemaker, showing up to numerous tribes. There's a wonderful book called He Walked the Americas by L. Taylor Hansen that documents the Native American tribe after Native American tribe talked about the appearance of Jesus in America. He's always called the peacemaker. There are numerous correspondences the Mormons have documented between Jesus and Quetzalcoatl. There are also, importantly, differences, but the similarities make us posit this very profound question. Did Jesus appear in America? Is he, in fact, coming back in 2012 as the Mayan, is the figure the Mayans identified as Quetzalcoatl? Is he traveling through this serpent rope or wormhole as a seraphim? You know, George, when in the book of Acts, when it talks about the ascension of Jesus after the resurrection, he ascends into the heavens. And there's this scene where the men of Galilee are gathered. Two men dressed in white, who might, in fact, be either Essenes or angels, ask the men of Galilee, why are you looking into the heavens for Jesus' return? He's going to return the same way he left. And in artwork, he is shown traveling in a portal or a gateway.
And where does religion come in here, William? I mean, did they get it wrong? Did they misinterpret? What happened?
Well, I think that religion, unfortunately, is largely, and I consider myself a godly man, not necessarily a religious man.
You believe, right?
Yes, I do. I believe that Jesus resurrected from the dead. I'm not of the opinion that he is our Lord and Savior, and I say this not to offend people. But I believe that my research into the original religion of Jesus, that he was talking about every individual is in the process of becoming a Christ-like being. That is the purpose of our earthly existence, is to embrace our highest selves and to awaken this consciousness. When Jesus is saying, follow me, he's saying, be like me. Do what I do. In fact, he said, we will do these things and even greater things. He sounds like he's coming out of the priesthood of Enki. And I believe he was, as a matter of fact. So when I'm talking about religion, I see religion as a controlling force, as a force that is trying to keep us locked in place. And I'm thinking all religions are like this. This is why we see so much conflict between the religions, especially in our present day. Islam and Christianity are literally, we're talking about racing towards the apocalypse because of religious beliefs, not spiritual beliefs. And when you step into the realm of religion, you're talking into the realm of dogma, and dogma is law. And if you don't subscribe to the law, you're an outlaw. And now this is where you have problems, and this has been the source of the wars. I mean, we talked about St. Francis. My God, he had to go deal with what I call the Nazi Pope, Pope Innocent III, who sent 30,000 stormtroopers into the Languedoc of southern France and exterminated as many as 1 million men, women, and children Cathars because they believed and professed that they possessed the original true religion of Jesus. So why is the Pope going after the Cathars to eradicate this high spiritual teaching? The answer is control.
It's all about control, isn't
it? It's all about control.
It always has been, always will be.
Exactly. So we get these stories that say, oh, you know, how dare you think that you can somehow transform yourself into one of these glorious beings? How dare you believe that you can transform yourself into a being of light? And after a while, people simply believe that they can't and don't pursue that path. And that's the trap. That's the whole wall that we're up against here that we're trying to scale at this present time, is to overcome that.
Let's get into 2012 if we can. What do you think is going to happen, William?
Well, first of all, we're in it now. It's already unfolding. And at the highest level, I see the manifestation of these beings. I mean, I am seriously tracking this Mayan symbolism that describes this alignment in 2012 as a sacred tree, as a cosmic tree. It's an energetic event is the key thing that this imagery of the sacred tree suggests to us, that there's going to be a two-way energy exchange. And I think that things can really heat up on this planet energetically, and that there could be a tremendous falling away of people that simply cannot handle this higher energy. And what I encourage people to do is right now to, the ancient term that they used is to live righteously, to speak truth, to speak your truth, and to recognize that we're in alignment right now with the throne of God. And I recommend or suggest that people behave that way. And if you are behaving that way, you're going to be operating out of your highest self. And I think you're going to be more fully protected, of course, than if you're not. And so that's what I'm seeing here, George, is that 2012 is an energetic event. I think we're going to be seeing higher energy coming from the center of the galaxy that could be detrimental to quite a few people.
But you do see it as an event of importance and of such a magnitude that it's not going to destroy the planet.
No, I don't see cataclysmic Earth changes, but I do see a scenario. I mean, based on the Christian prophecy of the return of Christ, they talk about above the cross of crucifixion, the sacred tree of crucifixion was an inscription that read INRI. Traditionally, that's interpreted as Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. It was a placard put there by Pontius Pilate. From the very beginning, the esoteric tradition has said, no, what that means is by fire, frequency, or vibration, humankind is made holy or whole. But the problem is that this energy, this Christos energy, this INRI energy, is so high that unless you're prepared to receive that energy, it's going to be like putting your finger in a light socket or walking into a blender. You're going to get your feathers ruffled. And the message that has always gone along with this INRI message is we have to raise our vibration. We have to eat better, we have to think better, and we have to do better things.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Upcoming events for you, you're going to be at Conscious Life in Los Angeles in February.
I'll be there too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We'll get together again. And what? Tell me about the Soul Rising event in Nashville.
I have every spring, I'm sorry, George.
Sure.
Every spring I have an event here in Nashville where
it's a great event too, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, and this year it's focused on my Soul Rising material. All new information focusing on the seraphim and how we raise our vibration.
And also, of course, William has events in Egypt. That's where you met Claire.
Yes.
You're going back. When is that?
In January, January 17th through February 2nd. We've got a couple seats available. Last-minute sign-ups can come over to williamhenry.net, get information, and join us. It truly is the trip of a lifetime.
And it's safe to go to Egypt these days, right?
Egypt is perfectly safe. It's in fact, they embrace people from the West. They're very, very open-hearted people, and it's, to me, one of the safest places on the planet, actually.
You know, we lost our dear friend Glenn Kimball this year, and he loved Egypt.
I know he did. I miss Glenn. I also miss our friend Lawrence Gardner. It has been a tough year in that regard, and then we lose Zachariah Sitchin on top of that.
They go in threes, William. Stick around. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take phone calls with William Henry next on Coast to Coast AM.